Welcome to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson. I'm Amanda Schager. Today on 30 Minutes, we continue with part two of a two-part series from a panel at the 2014 Festival of Books curated by the Pima County Public Library's Nuestras Raices. The talk is entitled Raza Studies, the Public Option for Revolution.
Our first presentation this morning is Raza Studies, the Public Option for Revolution. The well-known and controversial Mexican-American Studies MAS program in Arizona's Tucson Unified School District set out to create an equitable and excellent educational experience for Latino students. Panelists Dr. Julio Camarota and Dr. Agustin Romero, who helped create the program, will explore this progressive, indeed revolutionary, educational movement.
Along the lines of the encuentros, what we called them was Seolin Parent Encuentro. Seolin is Nahuatl, the Aztec language, which means one movement, parent encuentros, okay, parent encounter, one movement, parent encounters, colon, representation of blossoming intellectuals. What we recognized is this, is that when our children come to us and they walk through their doors, they are not acultural, they are not ahistorical, they are not intellectual. They are cultural, historical intellectuals. We recognize that intellectualism when they come to us, and we try to invoke and to actually have them take action with that intellectualism, to the point where when we would have these encuentros, these standing room encuentros only, the parents would say, did you just call my daughter an intellectual? Huh. And it's like, yes sir, I did. And go to her and explain to her what's going on. The other thing that would happen in the encuentros was that of 10 years worth of survey data, what we do know is that 96%, right? But 96% of our parents, our students said they would go home at night and talk to a parent or an adult about what they're learning in our classes. So we would get parents come to us and say, I had to come see this because I can't get her to shut up about this stuff. I had to come see what this is about. More importantly, unlike parent-teacher conferences or open houses where students are saying, oh, we don't got to go, in this situation, our students were dragging their parents there, saying you have to come see this. Because it was the opportunity for the student to show their parents their intellectualism.
Right.
The presentation, the things they've created, the things they're proud about. The idea that now this thing called education, it was them.
Yeah.
It was something they held on to.
Yeah, in many cases parents would want to come because we were transforming their child. Their child would be talking differently to them. So why is my child talking so differently now? So I got to find out what's going on.
Okay, I have to rein you intellectuals in too. So because we want to be able to ask questions, but I also don't want to end without a couple things. I mean, I want you guys to talk about the institute, because I think when Augie uses the word love, it's not contrived. It really isn't. I think I used to get accused a lot, I still do, of writing about this subject too much. You write about this too much, you know, you're obsessed. But I think if you're a parent in the school district, and I had a kid with special education issues, and to go in and see teachers in their classrooms who really did express that to their students was transforming for me personally, in the sense that I was like, wow, why the hell can't we have this in all the classrooms? Why can't we get the teachers' passion? And I think they did that through the institutes, no?
Yeah, the Institute for Transformative Education was something that, that was another blessing. It was such a blessing because what I had in my role was the capacity to recruit and bring in some of the greatest minds in our field, and then thereafter, after bringing those people in, they saw what we had going on here, and those folks became our friends. But what we were able to do for our teachers was expose them to, I mean, some of the very best folks, and spend some intimate time with those folks. So those folks would come in and do a keynote, and then they would do 2 1-hour sessions with just intimate conversation. And then equally important, later on, those folks became accessible to us and our teachers. And our teachers would commonly have conversations with the folks in terms of how to do this, how to do that. And as we built this friendship, this community beyond Tucson, it really helped our overall understanding of how we're what we're doing and how we're trying to do it. In many ways, it reinforced, reaffirmed the things we were already doing, but at the same time, it provided new perspectives to how we did and what we did. And what happened was, what you'll find is if you listen to teachers and you listen to the, if you read the chapter, teachers were totally invigorated. Teachers were found a new meaning to teaching. In fact, my uncle, who was a 23, 24-year veteran of TUSD, had never been to the Institute, but he came in 2010, and every day he was in tears. And he was, part of him was like, ah, I never knew. This is so powerful. Why aren't we exposed to this? He said, I've gotten 24 years of PD that were meaningless, and I come to this four-day institute, and it changed my life. So right.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Go ahead, Julio.
Yeah, I just want to say, Augie and I went around the country to different conferences, and we would meet some of the stars of multicultural education or ethnic studies or education. We'd meet them, and we would sit down with them, and we would tell them the work that we're doing. We're doing this transformative work. We're doing a lot of the work that's based on Paulo Freire and critical pedagogy. It connects a lot with the work that you're doing. Will you come to the Old Pueblo, right? None of them have ever been to Tucson. Tucson wasn't on their map. A lot of them would travel to places like New York or Chicago or California. But we were so blessed to have these incredible people come to Tucson and to help and work with our Tucson teachers. It was an incredible blessing, as Augie says.
You know, just kind of a funny note was, they didn't know that we were bringing them to Tucson in July. But
true.
The beauty of what we're doing, and they're connected to the work, some of them, even after knowing what July was like, they were willing to come back a second and third time. So, you know.
You guys recognize people in the audience, but you know, another person I think it'd be important to recognize is Nolan Cabrera his work.
We recognize,
because you know, one of the things that's in this book that's amazing is you people will argue against the numbers, you know, the transforming numbers of, you know, that was a big part of the fight for Mexican American studies was, you know, oh, these numbers are made up or these numbers aren't real. And it took Nolan Cabrera from the College of Education to come in and really go through all the figures. He presented the figures time and time again to the state, to the district. They ignored. So if anything, please, you know, look at that report is in there as well. The other thing too is that you guys talk about how the students changed you. Can you talk about that, and then we'll take some questions.
Well, in the transition in terms of recognition, can we just do that real quickly?
Okay. First off, I'd like to introduce my family. I have my family here. There's Rebecca Pina Camarota, my wife, and then my sister Carmen.
And I get the time to introduce my best friend and my wife, Edie. My mom is here. My suegra is here, Berta Soto. My cousin Lily is here. And then my daughter, Teresa Deanne Soto Romero, Lula D. My son, Raul Edgardo. My cousins, Yvonne and Callan are here. So thank you all for being here.
Awesome.
Oh, Andy! Sorry.
That's okay. I could introduce my mom, but she'd probably throw her
purse
at me. She's next to your mom and cousin. She's my biggest love. Talk about how it changed, how the students changed you, and what you heard from the teachers. Because that's something I always have heard you guys say. Yeah, we were changing them, but they end up changing us. How did that occur?
Well, early on, with this original cohort of 17 students, we would constantly ask them to tell us about their, have them tell us about their lives, about their experiences, about their troubles, about their problems, and also about their successes too. But finally, one of the students, and it was Kim Dominguez, spoke to us after class and said, you know, we're not going to trust you until you start telling about your life. We're not going to trust you.
Of course it would come from Kim Dominguez.
Right, of course. So we took the challenge, and we would have them do these I Am poems. I don't know if you're familiar with I Am poems, but these are identity poems, and where students would talk about their identity and who they are and what they're about, what their dreams are. And then, so after Kim challenged us, we both created I Am poems, and then did the I Am poems in front of the class, and that was a turning point. Mm-hmm. That really was a turning point, and it transformed how I thought about education. Education isn't just about the students and their life and their experiences. It's also about the teacher too and their life and their experiences and how these experiences come together and connect.
That's great.
Part of what Kim helped us and our students helped us understand was that if you're a teacher, if you're really going to develop a relationship with your children and your students, that you need to open up your soul. They need to see who you are. Not this shell that you walk into class with, but who you are. Very authentically, who are you? What are you about? And at the same time, what they'll do thereafter is they'll do the same for you. And then you have this building trust, this building relationship. And after you build this trust and this love-based relationship, it's at that point of time that we can be highly, highly, highly demanding. We can come at them in ways that other people can't come at them. If we didn't have that relationship and we came at them hard, they're like, hey man, don't get twisted on me. You know, where are you coming from? That's when they get defensive, because they don't know where you're coming from. But when we told them, or we would come at them and say, you didn't get this done. Why didn't you do this? Or you need to do this, or you need to do that, or you're accountable for this, or you're responsible for that. They recognize the idea that we were coming at them from a place of love, and that truly, truly, we were trying to push them to be better. Not just better students, better sons, better daughters, better community members, better intellectuals. All of those things interconnected simultaneously together. We were pushing those things.
We'll continue on 30 Minutes with Drs. Julio Camarota and Augustine Romero, moderated by Tucson Weekly writer Mari Herreras at the 2014 Festival of Books in a panel entitled Raza Studies, the Public Option for Revolution.
Okay, so I know there are a couple of things I still want to be able to have you guys start. Let's see if there are any questions.
Okay.
And I know that there's probably an author out there that's waiting in the wings. Are there any questions that folks want to
I want to say hello to Crystal right there. Crystal Foster, who's our current school board member, has been a supporter of our work forever, since before. She was a school board member, but is continuing her support of ethnic studies and Mexican-American studies.
Okay, where is the program now, and what do you see in terms of its future?
Okay, we're going to take that from two approaches. What's going on in TUSD, and then Hoodoo's going to talk about what's going on in the university, okay? We're blessed in the sense that in the district, TUSD's Unitary Status Plan, which is the plan by which hopefully we get our DSEG order, we have both the culture-responsive, culture-relevant courses embedded in the USP, as well as the multicultural curriculum. So we're in a situation now where, for all intents and purposes, the federal court has told us we need to re-implement these type of courses. Now, the courses themselves, I've talked about the idea all over the place, the idea that the courses are stronger now than they ever have been. And partly because what we did is, with the help of a lot of people, including Sal's here, I saw Kevin Kaiser Chuk over here, who helped develop the curriculum last year with us as well. We developed these seven different pieces of curricula that we then sent out and vetted with some of the top academicians in the country in these areas. And those people gave us their perspective on how to really develop the curriculum through a critical multicultural lens and a culturally relevant lens. So we got, not only as we had done in the past, we created our own curriculum and we vetted ourselves internally. But now this curriculum has been sent out to the experts, gone back, and we've made the necessary adjustments to that. The same time, what we've done is, some people can't believe the idea that I'm an advocate for the Common Core. For me, I'm not quite I wouldn't say an advocate, but like we did previously with the previous standards, No Child Left Behind standards, what we said then was, tell us what the standards are and then get out of our way. For us, the standards are the lowest hanging fruit. For us, the standards are the ceiling. We're going to a different place with our students. You know, this right here, okay, tell us what those are, get out of our way, because we're not stopping there. We're going well beyond that. So today what we have with our standards, with our curriculum, is we connected them to Common Core. We're infusing them and aligning them with the PARC assessment models. So for all intents and purposes, we have a stronger curriculum than we ever had before. And as I made mention before, that we have a leadership team with Dr. Sanchez, Dr. Vega, Mr. Holmes, Cami, Crystal, Adelita on our school board. I mean, we're in a really in a position where we have great opportunity. And now with Sal Gabadona board as well, I really feel, don't get me wrong, up until a few weeks ago, I was stressed as you couldn't imagine. My wife will tell you I haven't slept in months. Okay, but I feel today that we are really in a much better place. And I honestly believe that we're going to provide for our students and our community in the real near future is going to be as good or better than we ever did before.
Okay, I wanted to talk about a program that I helped to start here at the University of Arizona. It's sort of reigniting the social justice education project, the work that we did with these original cohort and subsequent cohorts, in which students conduct their own original research and they research themselves and their experiences in the community and in education as well. So I'm restarting it here at the University of Arizona with the cover of the University of Arizona, because supposedly we have academic freedom here, and we can then have the students read some of the books that were the state had questions about or state wanted to ban, right? But the books aren't banned, right?
No,
the books are not banned. I gotta say that, not anymore. They're not banned anymore. But this class allows high school students to come to the university, get university credit, and do the same kind of work that Augie and I developed over the years. We had difficulty getting it through because it had to go through a committee here at the university, and on that committee was someone who was against Mexican American studies in Tucson Unified School District. So, and they knew me, they knew the work that I have done, and they said, no, this guy's trying to get through the back door, right? Which really I was trying to get through the back door. So fortunately I had some great allies on this committee that respected what Augie and I were doing and understood what we were doing, and they voted, and this is the only time in the history of this university where they actually held a vote on a curriculum. Usually it's like everyone is like yay or nay, but this is the only time they actually voted on a curriculum. So they passed the curriculum through, and we're going to start this summer. This summer we're going to start our program. It's for high school students.
I got to be, in terms of what I was articulating in terms of the benefit for TUSD, I want to recognize Tiffany Mendibles Escobar. And I need to recognize her, and I already recognized Jessica, but in terms of being in a better place and in terms of doing this work, we need to recognize the efforts of our teachers. And with two young ladies like this in our program, I mean, we are in a really, really much better, I shouldn't say much better place, we're in a very strong place. And I want to recognize again the idea that our teachers in the former program were some of the most incredible teachers you could ever ask for. And it hurts me, and I'm almost getting teary right here, because you know, that thing that we had, it was so beautiful. And now it's incumbent upon this new group to help try to get us back there again. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm a teacher. I work in TUSD, a special education resource. And I was lucky enough to have as my first teachers my father and my mother. And so I knew, I learned a lot about my own history and my own heritage at home. I'm just wondering, what can we do to get the program into the middle school and elementary level. When I was in the classroom, I myself would call Mexican American Studies and someone would come out and do lessons with my students. But I don't see it happening, you know, at the elementary level like I wish I would be seeing it. And I'm just wondering, what are we going to do about that? Because we need it.
The real easy and the real solid answer is that in the Unitary Status Plan, it requires that we do those things. It requires that we pilot a middle school project and we figure out where feasible, how we drill it down to the elementary. But the other part of that is the multicultural piece. And where I see the most relevant, the easiest, and probably the most practical or pragmatic thing is regards to infusing the multicultural curriculum into the elementaries. What we're supposed to do, given the USP, is create a multicultural curriculum throughout all the disciplines in the entire district. So here in the relative near future, we're going to have a heavy multicultural strand. And in some cases, what some people may not appreciate, but others will appreciate, is what we consider to be the traditional canon today will no longer be the traditional canon tomorrow. And what I mean by that is that'll be transformed with multiculturalism and cultural relevancy. The theoretical framework, the pedagogical model, is, if you think about where it's coming from, at its core is Paulo Freire, which is liberatory, emancipatory, you know, the idea of how do you nurture critical consciousness? And through that critical consciousness, how do you nurture critical praxis? So for all intents and purposes, if you take a look at our writings from about 2004 when we first published to about 2008, what we called this was critically compassionate intellectualism, a model of transformative education for Latino students, okay? After 2008, we just started calling this a transformative model of education, because what we recognize is this is not just good for Latino students, it's good for students. It's an educational model, a strong educational model that regardless of where you place it, if you do it to fidelity, if you hold to its values, to its core, to its foundations, it's good for all kids. All kids. Your highest performing kids, your low performing kids, your middle kids. And if we really examine the research in culture responsiveness, a lot of that research comes from the ex-ed world. So, you know, we're tapping into a number of different areas in terms of how we really can go about implementing a truly transformative model for education. And that's what, in terms of, we need to recognize that what we talk about quite honestly and often is that our system, our education system, historically has let particular groups of kids behind, historically unserved populations. We need to start asking ourselves questions differently than the ones we've asked. Those kids are not at risk. What we have is a system that inherently creates risk for particular groups of kids. And the historical record shows that. Okay? So in terms of rethinking how we educate, and particularly those kids who are now in the, now unfortunately part of the prison industrial complex, we still can get to those children. We can still get to those young ones. Their world, their lives are still in front of them. They still have life. Therefore, the question becomes, how do you use it from this point forward? And unless they have this educational experience, which education can become a spiritual experience as well, you know, a higher sort of experience, if we can offer them that, and they themselves can, in what we talked about before with our students, was developing a sense of identity, purpose, and hope. Those people right there, don't they need that as well? Probably more so than other people. Identity, who they are, their purpose in the world, and the idea that they can become part of the contribution of creating greater hope in our world.
I also want to add that some colleagues of mine in New York have been doing work with juvenile justice in terms of this approach of education around participatory action research. So this is what I've been talking about in terms of students doing original research. The YPAR work, Youth Participatory Action Research, allows young people, particularly in this situation where they're institutionalized, allows them to reflect on the institution, look at the system, look how the system has failed them, right? Analyze how it's failed them, and then they come up with solutions on how to improve the system, improve the institution, so that the institutions work for them, as opposed to the institutions oppressing them. So this is a transformative model. So colleagues of mine have been doing work in New York around this. I haven't engaged. I would love to engage doing work in a juvenile justice system, doing this model. I think it would be transformative. I think what we do is really geared towards young people like that, that have, where I said the system has failed them. The system has created the situation that they're in. So this model works perfectly for them.
So essentially, when the critics say, "Well, why aren't we just going back to the basics of math?" Blah, blah, you know, we hear this online all the time. If you dare to go read that stuff. So yeah, I mean, we wouldn't need this if that system had worked to begin with.
Right,
no.
Right.
So I guess my final, I was gonna say, you know, the title, the fact that revolution is in the title, that all these words that
people have with the term revolution, people have such a negative perspective of that term. You know, they connect it to this idea of overthrowing the government. Revolution just means change. It just means transformation. It just means changing one's life or changing the lives of other people. That's what revolution means. And that's what we meant by the title of the book. Educational revolution, meaning that this is transformative education that transforms the lives of young people and transforms the lives of other people as well.
And what I meant by that question, though, is that, you know, this program, the different language, the terms, they've always seemed to frighten a group of people for lots of reasons, and mainly racism. But, you know, but there's no other way to describe transformation critical pedagogy, critical thinking.
You guys asked me not to get theoretical, but I'm going to throw a theoretical sort of notion at you. Richard Delgado talks about this thing called the theory of surplus equality. And what he talks about, the reality of the situation, is that there's not enough equality to go around. Therefore, you have a particular group of people who need to denounce people, need to relegate people to lower statuses so that they can protect the status quo. And in protecting the status quo, they can deny those other people the opportunities they may deserve. So those people, from my perspective at least, those people that are against us, who've come out against us, are afraid of a shift that could happen. They're afraid of the demographical shift that could happen and the political shift that potentially could come with that. And that's why their perspective is, we're out trying to overthrow the US government. And which is comical if it wasn't so real in terms of their perspective. But we unapologetically, as Julio said, we unapologetically were asking our children, our students, to look at the world differently, challenge that world, and create something different. We unapologetically were asking them to change their realities. And hopefully, the realities of their families, the reality of their communities, and as we move outwards, the reality of Arizona, the reality of the United States. Where this should go, I don't know. But again, we unapologetically asked our students to do those things.
That's great.
And from our perspective, that's one of the educational imperatives that we have the responsibility to do, is to help our children and those around them do better things, create a better world, and place themselves in a better situation.
You've been listening to Drs. Julio Camarota and Augustine Romero, moderated by Tucson Weekly writer Mari Herreras at the 2014 Festival of Books, and a panel entitled Raza Studies, the Public Option for Revolution. This has been part two of a two-part series held at the Pima County Public Library's Nuestras Raices Pavilion.